Hey, Fringe Voices listeners. As many of you know, this is a show in which I, James Ayler, interview interesting people about interesting ideas. I also wanted to let you know of an opportunity to support the show through Patreon. The link is in the show notes. I wanted to take us down an optimistic, hopeful path. So today we welcome Professor Harvey Kay. I hope you learned some new things along the way, and thanks for listening. All right, today we welcome Professor Harvey Kay. Professor Kay is a professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, and author of several books, more recently, Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, Thomas Paine, and The Promise of America. Dr. Kay, thanks for taking the time to join me today. How are you doing? And I hope you're staying healthy up in Wisconsin.
We're doing our damnedest to stay healthy. We were originally supposed to fly into New York City this very week. We canceled the flight. So, and this happens to be the start of spring break. And then already the university has canceled in-person teaching the week after spring break. And I just have a feeling they'll probably extend that. So, we're doing our best not to encounter large crowds. How's that?
That's good. Yeah, please don't. I wanted to start off. I enjoyed reading in your book, Take Hold of Our History, about how you discovered Thomas Paine. You said you were visiting your grandparents in Brooklyn, which is, hey, I love that. You're a Brooklyn guy. And When your grandparents would start to speak Yiddish, you knew it was time to go. And then you perused your grandpa's personal library and discovered books by Thomas Paine. Could you start off by speaking a little about your early life and the inspirations for your present mission in life?
Yeah, well, you know, I probably there were two or three things that really contributed to my political thinking before I knew there was such a thing as politics. And one was when my grandparents would come out to our house. My parents had moved out to New Jersey to a suburban home, like classic greatest generation family. And my grandfather brought out to Jersey one Sunday, coffee table size golden book, you know, a kid's book, but it was a golden book of Old Testament Bible stories. And he would tell those stories, and he would read this book to me when I was 5 years old or 4 years old, but he would read them to me as if they were sort of contemporary struggles. I have this vague recollection. The better way of explaining it is he would tell these Old Testament Bible stories and somehow weave together sort of Jewish immigration into New York City as sort of a moment of sort of liberation. I mean, it was just, I have a feeling that planted a seed in my head having to do with the whole idea of, you know, opposing exploitation and oppression and looking towards forms of liberation. That's my first thought. I mean, when somebody had asked me that years ago, I really reflected back and thought about that. But then the other thing was that when I discovered Thomas Paine, I thought, well, if my grandfather, who was a trial lawyer in the city, thought so much of Thomas Paine, I ought to pay attention. So I read various things by Paine in my teenage years, and I can't tell you I understood everything I was reading. It was more like I just had to do it. But over time, and especially later when I actually reclaimed my childhood hero as a middle-aged scholar almost, I had really decided that Paine was not just the guy who signed, or not signed, who authored, who composed the pamphlet Common Sense, which was this first great radical call for the American Revolution, to turn the American Rebellion into an American Revolution, but also that he was the guy who really sort of projected a vision of a United States as a democratic, and I underline or emphasize, italicize, democratic republic. I mean, he really was a radical, had tremendous confidence in his fellow citizens to be, and the possibilities, as he said, of starting the world all over again. And So I really, in many ways, see Paine as the real father, a godfather of America as an independent democratic republic. The other thing is that as I read on in Paine, we discover that he was not only this immigrant who becomes an American patriot, but when he goes back to Europe in order to try to find funds to build an iron bridge, he ends up involved in the French Revolution and the British struggles for democracy and the labor movement, basically. And he ends up writing, first of all, Rights of Man, which was a powerful pamphlet during the French Revolution, two-volume pamphlet during the French Revolution. And then even beyond that, while still in France, he writes a pamphlet entitled Rights of Man. And this really is the sort of initial, if you like, treatise or call for what we would call social democracy, where he actually calls on people of, you know, who are enduring modern civilization as he saw it, and the creation at which resulted in poverty and inequality. He says it's imperative that we create a democracy or a democratic republic in which a fund will exist. And those who monopolize land, the big landholders who were the great property holders of their day, they owed a tax to everyone else, because God didn't intend for there to be a monopolization of property, that we all should have a share in the earth. And he said, but since they have this property, then they are obliged, morally and otherwise obliged, to pay a tax to the community or the nation. And that should go into this fund. And then that fund should be used to combat poverty in two ways. First of all, young people, when they reach the age of maturity, should be given, that was boys and girls, men and women, should be given a stake, S-T-A-K-E, a grant to enable them maybe to buy land or get an education or set themselves up in a trade or a business, give them a start, you might say. And also, this was a fund which would underwrite something he had already talked about in part in Rights of Man, what we've come to know as Social Security. So here we are in the 1790s, and Thomas Paine is already talking about, well, he's already talking, if, for lack of a better way of putting it, if we want to think in contemporary terms, of free tuition as far as you can go in education, you know, a grant or some kind of grant to get trained to become a, you know, skilled worker or business person, whatever it might be, on the one hand. And on the other hand, he's talking about Social Security. Okay. So, you know, I just think Paine was this remarkable guy, and I by accident, or well, at least by family accident, my grandfather had these books that led me into being interested in him. And it was really only in the early 1990s when a particular opportunity arose, and I won't bother to tell the whole story, that I had a chance to write something about Thomas Paine. And I guess I didn't ever really look back. I went from a piece in a book that I was editing about Thomas Paine. Later, I did a young adult biography of Thomas Paine for Oxford University Press, which, as long as you're in New York, I'll tell you, won the prize of the New York Public Library for the best book for the teen age.
Wow. And then
I thought, I'm not giving up my hero so soon. And I set out to write a book about Thomas Paine, not only his life and labors, but also the way in which conservatives for generation upon generation tried to suppress his memory. And then I even had the idea I'd bring Thomas Paine back to life and sort of have a sort of fun conversation with him, all in the course of this one book, which turned into something completely different titled Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Because what I discovered is Americans in every generation, every progressive movement, every radical movement, every fighting liberal movement from the time of the revolution to today have always reached back to the revolution and rediscovered Thomas Paine. His work has never been out of print. And for all of the efforts of the propertied and the pious and the powerful to suppress Paine's memory, they could never do it.
That. And speaking of Thomas Paine, before we get into FDR, I'm quoting from your recent book that you were speaking of. In any case, the battle is no longer over the question of whether we will publicly remember Paine, but what we will remember him for. And it remains critical to the struggle for American democracy. In addition to the couple of things that you did mention about Thomas Paine, what are some other key things citizens should remember Thomas Paine for at this present moment?
Well, let me put it this way. Americans, I think, ever since Thomas Paine's Common Sense and his work in the Revolution, have really carried sort of a sense of an imperative, or if you like, an impulse that Americans are meant to be radical, that they're not supposed to put up with subjection of any form, subjection in politics, subjection in their economic lives or working lives, subjection in their cultural lives. And when Americans feel anxious about the state of the nation, which is only proper, and I mean, whether it's, you know, been in under the Carter or the Clinton or the Obama years on the one hand, or even more awfully, the Reagan years and then the Bush years and now the Trump years, which are the worst of all, obviously, that the reason they feel as anxious as they do is not simply because in Trump's case he's just so vile and so connected to these corporate Republicans, these reactionaries, but also because as an American, we grow up and we've been imbued with this sense of radicalism. And if we want to know why, we have to think about Thomas Paine. It may well help that if we know more about pain, or even more importantly, that we remember the words that might be in the deepest recesses of our American memories, that we'll be all the more equipped and all the more outfitted and all the more determined to do as Thomas Paine actually said. And I think this, it may seem outrageous. He said Americans had it in their power to start the world all over again. At the least, we have it in our power to make a nation freer, more equal, and more democratic.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you a question about FDR, but this brings it's a good segue into the energy that you're speaking of. People are, you know, like it's imbued within the American citizen to be radical. I feel like all the working class, young, and other people that continue to vote for Bernie are ready to act to enable, and we can get into the four freedoms that FDR envisioned so long ago.
I'll just say a response to the energies you're referring to. Look, before the election of 2016, we saw a lot of energies in diverse ways. So we saw, you know, Black Lives Matter, the fight for 15. Before that, we saw Occupy here in Wisconsin. We, working people in Wisconsin, especially public employees, occupied the state capitol, along with many students from Madison, demanding the restoration of our collective bargaining rights, our union rights, you might say. And so you see these kinds of things, and I could go on, and there were other movements too that were emerging and continue to emerge even after Trump was elected, such as Me Too and Moral Monday, which began before, I guess, and continued after. But here's the thing, okay? The thing is that those movements never cohered. They never came together. They each had a primary agenda. And this is where the Democrats truly failed us. Because I'm not saying by accident. I think they had no desire to mobilize Americans in favor of any kind of radical, or let's be even softer about it, progressive transformation. But a really phenomenal leader, the kind of leader that FDR was, and now in many ways, Bernie, though I have some criticisms, but in many ways, Bernie is someone who will not only say will fight for us, as Hillary Clinton told us over and over again, but actually a leader who will encourage the fight in us. Because any leader who's truly a small D Democratic leader will know that, especially given the division in the country now and the hold that conservative priorities have over Congress, both Republican and in many ways so among the Democrats, indeed, it's the case that you're going to need Americans not only in Congress to support what you want, but in the streets supporting what you want. So that's really crucial.
I think you're right. And, you know, one thing that you did mention in your book is that, and I think this is a criticism that a lot of people have brought up, is that, yeah, I would vote for Bernie. His ideas are great, but I don't think he could implement them. How did FDR implement the New Deal, and were there struggles with implementing that, and could we learn lessons from that?
Yeah, well, you know that expression, timing is everything? Well, Roosevelt had always been a progressive, and indeed what he would call, you know, a very aggressive liberal Democrat. In fact, he changed the very meaning of liberalism by way of his own presidency and the Americans who supported him. But when he was elected, the Democrats had already gained control of Congress. And then in 1934, based on how much Americans supported his desire to pursue a New Deal and empower working people, et cetera, the Democrats had overwhelming control of Congress. I mean, the Republican Party was on it, in some ways, looked to be on their last legs at that moment. The only thing was, here's the thing, FDR had to deal with a divided Democratic Party. So you had what would be, we would might think of as more liberal Democrats in the North and out West. And then you had these conservative white supremacist Democrats in the South, the ones who wanted to hold on to the Jim Crow segregationist regime. Now, the Southern Democrats were more than happy to have Roosevelt used the federal budget to basically send monies to the South. Southern Democrats and now Republicans, they don't mind sending monies down South as long as it doesn't enhance democratic life, but rather sustains the inequalities that prevail. But it is the case that Roosevelt found his way, to start pursuing very, very progressive, in many cases, radical legislative changes. But he knew he had to put up with certain kinds of some kinds of, for lack of a better word, you know, sort of reactionary elements inside of the laws that he wanted to enact. So, for example, the Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act, both of which were passed by Congress in 1935, because Southerners controlled the committees in Congress, Southern Democrats, they wrote the Social Security law in 1935 in a way to exclude African-Americans, not all, but especially African-Americans in the South who were either agricultural workers or sharecroppers. Okay, so that, because they left agriculture out of the Social Security Act in 1935. And Roosevelt himself had probably had to ask himself, is it worth doing if people are left out? And his feeling was, yes, because we can take care of this in future Congresses. We can expand it. And we'll just say that even though he didn't get to do it effectively, between Truman and Eisenhower, they did so. The other thing was that he also wanted in the Social Security Act national health care, what we would think of as Medicare for All, back in 1935.
Wow.
But the Republicans and the corporations and the doctors through the American Medical Association were absolutely opposed to it and threatened to literally mobilize at the grassroots to block Social Security. So what did he do? He left national health care out of Social Security. And it really isn't until the 1960s, in a public fashion, under Johnson, that the generation that was growing up in the 30s and fought World War II was finally able at least to enact Medicare and Medicaid as part of Social Security. So, but the point is that he was successful in really pursuing radical ends, understanding that the radicalism that might, you know, be embedded in these laws were not necessarily going to be as radical as he had hoped. One last thing, because as long as we're in 1935, it was 1935, recognizing the opposition that they faced, however much they controlled Congress, he actually told Americans that new laws in themselves do not bring the new millennium. That is, more than laws are required to make sure the changes actually take place. Because he knew that, and this is all in the record, he knew that the industrial corporations were stockpiling weapons. Armories to fight off workers. And that's especially regarding the National Labor Relations Act, which was not only a law that guaranteed workers the right to vote, the right to organize unions and have collective bargaining. It actually placed the federal government behind their efforts to do so. And so Roosevelt's administration, what he may have hesitated at times, was not simply a liberal reform effort. It really did have radical and revolutionary elements in it. And basically, he was fulfilling what he said to a friend in 1931 in the midst of the Great Depression, when he said, I think it's time for this country to go fairly radical for a generation. And then along the way, and I've just edited, I know others can't see it, I'll show you. I've just edited this book that's coming out next month.
Wow.
FDR and Democracy, a collection of his, you know, most progressive speeches, and in some cases revolutionary speeches that generally are left off the record. But I'll just tell you that FDR, when he spoke to Americans, he had in mind not just trying to impress them that he was going to fight for them, but also to encourage them to fight with him versus corporations, conservatives, and reactionaries.
I like that. And that's actually a good segue to get into. Yeah, I mean, what are some valid criticisms of the current Bernie Sanders campaign that could help move the way forward with this campaign?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing, there was something you were going to ask me that I just want to put in the insert now. So maybe the Bernie thing can make a little more sense when I mention it.
Okay.
So FDR's, some of FDR's speeches are renowned, okay, the Pearl Harbor Day speech, right, the day that shall live in infamy, and his speech when he was becoming president, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. I mean, there are words that have become part of our sort of political roster of quotations. But here's the other thing. From the start to the finish, for all of his faults and failings, and let's not forget, I mean, he failed to lift the immigration quotas because of opposition in Congress that would have allowed more Jewish refugees into the country at the outset of World War II. he allowed the military hierarchy to persuade him to create a segregated army and navy, okay, and which, you know, people will never, won't forget. But and then third, he actually allowed property holders and conservatives in California and military officials to literally order the internment of Japanese Americans who were living on the West Coast, moving them to camps in the West and the South Central states. So this is not a saint, okay? He made some terrible and tragic decisions. But it is the case that all the way along, from 1932 when he's running for president to 1936 when he's running for president again, to 1941, when he offers a State of the Union address that I'll mention in a moment, to 1944, when he offers a State of the Union address, which offers a vision of America after the war, he's always pushing the idea of democracy. And just to say, Jews and African Americans and Japanese Americans refuse to allow anyone to define them as any less of an American citizen or any less of an American than anybody else. And they fought, you know, valiantly and courageously, and in the case of Jews, especially out of their numbers, you might say, as a part of the population. So let's just make that clear. But here's the thing: in 1932, when Roosevelt was running, he actually called for an economic declaration of rights, which, you know, was there and basically sort of informs the New Deal. In 1936, he actually says, you know, hey, you know, the corporate leaders basically are accusing us of overturning American, you know, what America is about. He said, no, what they're really afraid of is that we're going to overturn the power that they possess. That, you know, he sort of said, you bet, we're prepared to stage, if you like, some kind of Democrat, small d, democratic revolution. And then in 1941, he goes before the nation in January of 41, before we're ever involved in the war, but the rest of the world is already in World War II. And he calls for Americans to turn the nation into the arsenal of democracy to provide the wherewithal to Britain and its allies to withstand the German onslaught and the Blitzkrieg. But also he says, and we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, or what we would say freedom of religion. And then he goes on from what would have already was already in the Bill of Rights and says freedom from want and freedom from fear. And there are lots of people who didn't necessarily applaud both of those. Republicans didn't care for the freedom from want too much. And Southern Democrats, the white supremacists who would later become Dixiecrats, they didn't care too much for freedom from fear because they thought that meant he was going to go after segregation. Okay. And that becomes basically the ideals of World War II that we fought for. And then in 1944, he returns in many ways to that idea of an economic declaration of rights and freedom from want and fear. And in his State of the Union message actually calls for an economic bill of rights, which will then help us segue all the more to Bernie Sanders. So there's a legacy and a generation is created. The greatest generation is not simply the folks who fought the war. They're the folks who fought the Depression, who fought for the four freedoms, and who, as mature middle-aged adults in the 1960s, again, for all of their faults and failings, the majority elected one of the most liberal Congresses, where that enabled Johnson, with the struggles going on among African Americans and others, to pass civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, environmental protections, workplace protections, marketplace protections, immigration reform. I mean, this is a generation that was, I think, was the most progressive in American history. Having said that, now let's think about Bernie, okay? And Bernie, from his earliest years, has called himself a democratic socialist, which essentially means, if you look closely at the ideals and the plans, not something very much like Roosevelt's liberalism, or if we prefer, both FDR and Bernie Sanders are, if you like, radical social democrats. They want to pursue democratic transformations. So FDR pursued the New Deal with the support of the labor movement. Bernie Sanders wants to create, because we face a crisis, the Green New Deal. FDR, with the National Labor Relations Act, wanted to empower workers. Bernie Sanders, if you go to his website, talks about workplace democracy. FDR enacts Social Security, which he wanted to include universal health care as a part of. Bernie Sanders is pushing for Medicare for all. Franklin Roosevelt called for an economic bill of rights, which included health care, which included the right to an education as far as you're able to pursue it. Bernie Sanders is talking about all of those kinds of things and tuition-free public higher education, which FDR would definitely have endorsed. Absolutely. Now, let me make something else clear. Franklin Roosevelt was a brilliant political figure, mobilized Americans when it was imperative to do so. And he also never, ever forgot that what he was saying was that he was putting into words what he knew his fellow citizens wanted. So, for example, in 1943, he actually ran surveys. What do Americans want after the war? And what he discovered through those surveys was that 85% of Americans wanted national health care coverage. In 1943 and 44, when he called for an economic bill of rights, he was really putting into political words what he knew his fellow citizens desired. Now, what we discovered these last few weeks, all the more, is that even if Americans have turned to Biden, Democrats at least, turned to Biden at certain moments because they've been persuaded that somehow Bernie's unelectable or his programs might be too expensive, the overwhelming majority of Americans want universal health care. They say that in the exit polls, okay? And by the way, nearly 50% actually do want some kind of radical transformation of the economy to empower workers, to fight inequality. So Bernie Sanders is not like talking off the top of his head or merely grabbing hold of some foreign set of ideas. He's talking American history, even though he doesn't make that case strongly enough, and he's talking what Americans want to do with the nation. And so you asked me about my criticisms of Bernie. Here's what I think. I think Bernie Sanders is a remarkable political figure. He has literally shocked the system because his appeal is so overwhelmingly. Here's a guy who's like in his 70s, who's, you know, this Jewish boy from Brooklyn, New York, who's now a senator from Vermont with this great accent of his out of the New York area. And in 2016, and once again today, who are the folks who are sort of, you know, thronging to his call for democracy? Young people, right? In their 20s, in their 30s, and into their 40s. So Bernie Sanders, in many ways, is phenomenal. But here's the thing. He's allowed his opponents, the pseudo-Democrats, the people who have forgotten Franklin Roosevelt, who have forgotten what it means to be a capital D Democrat and a small D Democrat. And how dare they, I often say, stand on a platform, on a panel of Democratic candidates and turn to Bernie and go after him because Medicare for all would be too expensive. What utter bullshit. Okay. Number one, we pay for the defense budget. We find the money. Well, think about it. Two, the Republicans gave a massive $1 trillion tax cut to the very rich and big business. So the point is you fight to change that. And you fight in order to make sure that no one in America goes without health care. And of course, now we confront a massive health care crisis. OK, we're unprepared to face the pandemic, which a national health program would not have disabled us in this way. And definitely not one led by Bernie Sanders or, for that matter, probably even Barack Obama. OK, but moreover, we face over the horizon when we transcend to get over this crisis. And I hope we don't lose too many lives in the process. There are going to be other pandemics. Or think about it this way. If you don't have health care, which too many millions of Americans do not, the fact is you're living a pandemic all the time. People need to realize that. I'd like to hear Bernie say that tomorrow night. We are confronting a crisis right now that if we're lucky, because we've been all hunkering down in our homes, if we don't have to go out to work, maybe we won't, you know, see the kinds of death figures that people seem to be worried about. But it's still the case that we're in the middle of a, can I say F word?
Sure.
We're in the middle of a fucking crisis that didn't have to be the crisis it is. And basically speaking, one of the key ingredients to preventing these kinds of crises is Medicare for all, or if you don't like the term, healthcare for all. So Bernie, what I'm asking Bernie to do, and we've got this one big shot tomorrow night. This is the first time it's one-on-one, Bernie and Biden. This is the time where he's going to be looking out at the nation and not out to an audience of rich people who bought their way into the debate. And what he needs to do is he needs to channel, I don't believe in channeling as a spiritual thing, but he needs to, as an intellectual and moral thing, he needs to channel FDR and he needs to look out at Americans and he needs to play history teacher in chief and remind Americans that it is that social democracy going all the way back to Thomas Paine, and I could talk about Lincoln as well, but all the way through American history, social democracy is 100% American. It is not a foreign import. It is 100% American. Though, believe me, generations of immigrants brought with them marvelous commitments to social democracy and to labor unionism, which is what makes American diversity as remarkable as it is. That's first. And then he needs to sort of channel FDR and talk about the fact that in this country, no one should be allowed to go without health care. And by the way, we can afford it, just as we afforded the fighting of the revolution, the fighting of the Civil War to suppress the white supremacists then, just as we fought the Great Depression, just as we fought the war against fascism. We can do it.
I like it. That is actually your inspiration and some things that were in your current book. But I just want people to replay what Professor K was saying, because I think it's so important. I know we both have tight schedules and I don't want to take up too much of your time. What you mentioned several interesting people in your book, your more recent book. However, who is an important early thinker others should know about and read about right now?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I've already pushed Thomas Paine pretty powerfully. But there are other people. You know, I think one could really do well. You go online, and we're all stuck online pretty much as opposed to going into crowds these days. But, you know, go online and look up Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the Declaration of Sentiments, and how the women in 1848 at the Seneca Falls Convention, the first great conference for women's rights and equality, how they grabbed hold of the Declaration with its, you know, promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and they rewrote the Declaration to be a universal declaration and not simply a declaration for men. So all men and women are created equal. Have a look at it. It's not very long, and it'll remind you that the struggle that we think of as Me Too has been a long one. Second thing, I would say, go online. It's not terribly long. It's longish as a speech or sermon. Frederick Douglass, the great black abolitionist who emancipated himself in the antebellum years, came north and became America's greatest orator of the first half of the 19th century. He gave a speech in 1852, I think it was, titled "What to the Slave is the 4th of July." Read it. Wow. The very closing pages will surprise you. He lambastes Americans for their failure to honor the Declaration all the way through, okay? And he chastises his fellow citizens. And then the end, he then says, "And yet I do not despair." And I'll leave the words to Frederick Douglass. Read Frederick Douglass. Another person who I haven't had a chance to talk about is Lincoln. Lincoln's speeches are phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Which may well be one of the reasons why Lincoln and FDR together, we always consider our two greatest presidents. And often we throw Washington in, if not because he was first president, but also because he was a great military leader, ultimately. So here's the deal. So read Lincoln's speeches. You know, I know it's a joke for a lot of people because it's the kind of thing you did in high school. Read the Gettysburg Address. Let that remind you of what it means to be an American confronting a crisis. Then go on and read Eugene Debs, the great socialist of the late night, first a labor leader, then a socialist candidate for president. Talk about great speech making. When people asked him who his heroes were, he would say Jesus Christ, Patrick Henry, and especially Thomas Paine, because he just loved Paine's democratic spirit. And he didn't hesitate to grab hold of American history, both in his speeches and when he was defending himself against the Wilson administration in 1918. So there are lots of figures who we can grab hold of. And notice, I'm not telling people to read some big, hefty book. Read the speeches. Right, speeches are wonderful, okay? Take, you know, at night in bed, you know, if you got an iPad or a phone, just read these things. They won't put you to sleep. They'll give you ideas. They'll give you better dreams, you know? So there you go.
Thank you, Professor K. I appreciate your intelligent remarks and intelligent criticism and, you know, not productive criticism of how we can spread this burning mess forward. Thank you for talking with me today and taking the time. I appreciate it. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, James. And if anyone's interested, I'm on Twitter at at Harvey J-K, H-A-R-V-E-Y, initial J, K-A-Y-E.
Right. I'm so sorry. I did want to mention that. And I'm also going to put in the show notes links to your books to the Twitter account, and we'll spread your spread your good word. And then also, you did have a new project coming up. Could you just, before we end, could you briefly speak about that again? You mentioned it earlier.
Well, because of Bernie and the earlier work I did on Franklin Roosevelt and the Greatest Generation, I decided it was time for a good, strong collection of Roosevelt speeches. So I've edited, and it's coming out in April, a volume entitled FDR on Democracy, the Truly Greatest Speeches of Franklin Roosevelt. And there are some speeches in there from his early years, which have never been available for some time. And I've edited them down. So it's not like you have to read terribly long addresses, but there are lots of speeches, up to 40, I think there are in there. That's the first thing. And over the horizon, I've played with the idea of maybe having, sounds like I'm on drugs when I say this, but I thought maybe it would be nice to have conversations with history, as I, historians do that in a way. But maybe I should have real conversations with American radicals of the past and try to write it up in a creative writing fashion. That's one thought. Or the other thought is to put together a collection of Lincoln's speeches specifically pointing towards democracy, though in fact almost all of his speeches do that. So those are the two things I'm playing with in my head.
Awesome. Well, I'm interested in both of them. I hope you can pursue both of them. I know it's an incredible amount of work.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
If I'm stuck in the house long enough, I can at least maybe decide what I want to do.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Professor Kay. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, James. We'll stay in touch.
Okay.